This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
Kenneth A. Shepsley's research uses quantitative tools, including game theory, to analyze political institutions and intergenerational politics. He is the author of 11 books on topics including congressional procedures, political economy, and electoral competition. Currently, the George D. Markham Professor of Government at Harvard University, Shepsley is also a founding member of that Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. He was a national fellow at the Hoover Institution, a fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, and a Guggenheim Fellow. In 1990, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences.
You have your undergraduate degree in mathematics and
political science.
Political science?
Yes.
That seems like two very different areas to be interested in. Was this something from a younger time that you were...
Well, today it's a lot less unusual. Then it was extremely weird. I was a mathematics major at North Carolina, and I got closed out of a mathematical physics course, and my advisor, who was a chemist, said, well, you've been working very hard. Why don't you take something easy like political science? And I'd always been interested in politics and read a lot of American political history. So I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And I took it and really, really enjoyed it. And so I kept taking political science and mathematics and ended up with a joint degree. It was an accident. There we are.
Was mathematics a first love of sorts?
I guess. I mean, I don't think I was ever all that good at it. I mean, good enough, but I thought momentarily about going to graduate school in mathematics, but decided political science seemed much more my passion by that time. And there was one graduate program in the country that did combine these two seemingly opposing subjects. And so I went to the University of Rochester for their PhD program.
And this was completely happenstance. You had already taken these two separate roads in a way, and then you found the graduate school for that?
Yes, although while I was an undergraduate, there were a number of younger faculty members in political science who encouraged me, who said this is really a direction in which political science is going and will be going. And so I can't say I was completely without guidance, and it was completely fortuitous, but it was still very, very unusual. And the graduate program at the University of Rochester mainly consisted of people who were failed mathematicians, failed physicists, failed engineers. So all of us were there with some background in quantitative work and mathematical work, but we all were kind of interested in applying it to politics.
But was that sort of surprising to you to find that you could meld the two?
No, I kind of came kind of naturally to it. I mean, I sort of thought analytically about things, and so... I'm not sure I'd worked it all out in my own mind at that point, but I certainly didn't think of it as a struggle of any sort.
Did your upbringing have any connections to politics or mathematics?
I grew up in Washington, D.C. Walter Cronkite and Roger Mudd were my local TV announcers. Yeah, politics, the Washington Post was the daily newspapers. Yeah, so I sort of grew up being quite intrigued by what was going on in the company town I lived in.
Was your family in the...
No, I mean, there was sort of amateur suburban politics,
right.
But nothing much more than that.
But it was the osmosis.
Yeah.
And you read the paper when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah.
And kept
sure.
up with everything?
Oh, sure. Yeah, even growing up in Washington, I don't know that I thought of myself as being interested in politics, mm-hmm. much more in sort of American political history. And it was a time of the Kennedy-Nixon race when I was in high school, and that was really quite a significant event. I mean, I can remember it being the heightened interest in it among kids, among teenagers, more so than I would say the Bush-Kerry race evoked. So there was a great deal of interest in, and then Kennedy was president, and he was this vibrant, youthful, charismatic guy, and so I think there was a lot of attraction and interest in politics. You still see that today. I mean, enrollments in political science courses at universities go up in election year.
It seems to me that the public in general is kind of more interested in politics these days and more aware of some of the process.
Maybe
not in a good way,
well,
but they talk about it.
I mean, I could imagine various mobilization efforts by the Republicans to mobilize ordinary people on the one hand, and the Iraq war on the other hand, being such milestones, I guess, salient events that it would evoke interest. But mostly in Boston, they talk about the Red Sox.
When you were growing up and you were in this sort of political milieu in the hotbed, were you interested in political process at that point?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I had a very subtle idea. I think I just liked to argue. And, you know, my parents were easy to bait. The dinner table really did become a place where a lot of discussions, animated discussions about current events occurred. Not because it was a particularly intellectual family, but we just all liked to argue. And so we did. And it was all good-natured. And my mother was quite liberal and democratic. My father was much more of a conservative person who typically voted Democratic anyhow, but did vote for Eisenhower because, as he said, he fought with him in the war. So there was a lot of political discussion in the house.
So by the time you were off to your undergrad, you were...
I was pretty interested in politics, yeah. When I was an undergraduate, I was at North Carolina.
You were at UNC, right?
Yes.
And at UNC, you were doing math.
Started in mathematics and then took politics and got very interested in that and took a little economics and sociology and psychology. I mean, I really dove into the social sciences. I regret not taking very much literature or art or music. It was mainly the mathematics and the sciences associated with that, physics and chemistry, and then later on taking a lot of social science.
So then on to University of Rochester,
yeah.
You had specific...
Well, the University of Rochester was unusual. It had a former member of the National Academy, he's no longer alive, William Riker, had come to the University of Rochester a few years earlier with the express charge to create a graduate program. And Riker was this very unusual man who had a traditional Harvard PhD and had taught at small colleges in the Midwest, but came to Rochester to create something that had a more scientific foundation. And so he created this graduate program, which was heavily mathematical and quantitative, and hired a bunch of young faculty who shared his vision. And so there was a faculty with most everybody on the same page intellectually, and through selection biases of various sorts, there were a bunch of us students there that all kind of got the bug. And so it was really an amazingly cohesive and exciting place. And all of us, as we finished our PhDs, assumed we would be on minor tributaries most of our careers, that this was very much out of the mainstream. So people got jobs at Carnegie Mellon and Caltech, and I went to Washington University and Michigan State, and Emory, and you know, fine institutions, but not major scientific research institutions, at least in the social sciences. And so that was really what life was like for the first decade, I suppose.
Previous to the Professor Riker arriving at Rochester, the era before, was there not a quantitative method applied to these things?
The scientific impulse in political science was mainly empirical, and it was associated very much with the University of Michigan, and it involved statistical analysis of large N studies, as we call them today, large data sets. The earliest of these were associated with American national elections and heavily based on survey research. So there were a generation of scholars throughout the 1960s and well into the 1970s that approached doing scientific political science with a psychological model of voters in their mind and survey research instruments and statistical tools to analyze survey data. That was one of the mainstreams in political science. In fact, that was what I read when I was an undergraduate. And I was quite excited about that and probably didn't really appreciate the fact that my more analytical and axiomatic interests were very much different than these. To me, it was all just doing science. And
methodologically different, or?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought through the fact that these were somewhat different approaches to trying to produce knowledge. you know, one got more subtle as I guess one gets older. But at the time, it was just a bunch of clubs that you wanted in your golf bag, and you know, you wanted to learn them all. So and that was really what graduate education was, really learning all of the tools that were available.
Were those helpful, even though what you were doing was completely different in the end? Was it helpful to have that as a basis?
Oh, yeah. I think scientific political science is but a part of the discipline. Political science is a fairly old term. It was actually, I believe, first used by Alexander Hamilton in an era when the systematic study of constitutions was probably as advanced as the systematic study of the planets. So that political science and astronomy in 1776 were probably roughly comparable in terms of their knowledge of their subjects. And if you fast forward several centuries, the natural sciences were on a much steeper trajectory than political science. And the founding fathers very much believed that you could be systematic and analytical about the mechanical features of governments, just like in mechanics and physics. But in political science, as it was in mid-century, 20th century, it was a conglomeration of people that were scientifically inclined, people that were philosophically inclined, people that were interested in describing the history, the language, the culture, and the politics of a particular region of the world, and we were all kind of under one big tent. And a large department like Harvard's or Berkeley's or Michigan's was thought of as a full-service department that covered the waterfront, whereas other departments might specialize in bits of political science. But the scientific group, which was one of these factions inside the tent, we were all, I mean, even if we were doing slightly different things, we were all fellow travelers and felt presumptuously we were the vanguard, of course, but also that we would either hang together or hang separately, as they say. And we, I think, thought of each other as doing complementary kinds of things. And so there wasn't any particular tension or animosity among the more empirically inclined and the more analytically inclined.
That seems kind of rare in a way. Maybe that's just because nowadays that things are more divided in general.
Yeah, I don't think it lasted a whole long time. I mean, I think various competitive juices began to flow. Whether it was competition over research resources or competition over slots. So there began to be this, I want someone from my tribe, I want my research grant to be funded. So, I mean, I'm sure that there was, at the end of the day, this kind of competition. But I think, actually, even over the 40 or 50 years, that it's been a fairly cooperative endeavor. The Michigan School people would not be put off entirely by the Rochester School types. And there were indeed times when the two joined at a seam.
And collaborate?
There would be collaboration, sure. And there would be cross-fertilization. I mean, if you look at Michigan today, it's filled with both very empirically inclined scholars and very theoretically inclined scholars. And so there's much more blending and mixing, and departments felt they needed strength in all of these aspects.
There had been more of the quantitative and analytical basis before the sort of
statistical.
Would the knowledge have been much different at that point where they started together, where actually the, I guess, where the empirical did begin?
Counterfactual history is a tricky business.
Yeah.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I actually think that at the end of the day, the analytical scholar either is theorizing in his or her mind in creative ways, or has some real-world regularity they're interested in. And I think the fact that the Michigan people were intent upon uncovering real-world regularities was an important development. And I think a lot of sciences do begin with simple description and discoveries of regularities. And it's really at that point that you say, why? And you begin spinning out ideas about why the world might line up in that particular way.
So you can't really call them non-scientific for that reason.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think it was a healthy development. I think a lot of what we call formal theorists now, people who do mathematical models, often will pay no attention to the real world as they creatively invent a world of their own. But at some point, you want to have your idea pass a test. It's got to be consistent with something out there. And when it's not consistent, you want to go back and tinker with your theory. So I think thinking of regularities as constraints on creativity, that's a healthy development. Most of the, as I say, most of the regularities are in the early days were uncovered via survey methods. They had, you know, among the many costs and benefits of World War II, the development of survey methodology, principally, I guess, by psychologists and sociologists, but spilling over into political science, was a godsend. We got much more sophisticated about how to create data to measure things. And so these two are part and parcel of what science is all about. So I'm not sure it would have been a better development. I think of Aristotle as being the type of guy who, or Plato actually, better yet, who theorizes without much data. Aristotle actually collected data.
But by the time the theoretical people, the formal theorists came in, I guess, was it a bloodbath in terms of the stuff that was there? Were they able to just work with the given theory up to that point? Was a lot of stuff thrown out? Or did it pretty much really fit in there?
The early formal theorists, with the main exception of Riker, were economists who engaged in argument by analogy. So a quite significant economist named Anthony Downs said, well, if we have models of the competition of firms, and if we assume in a small town there's a main street, and we ask where will Kresge's and Woolworth's locate, it turns out that they converge toward each other. That they assume that customers are going to go to the one that's closest to them, and they want to be close to as many customers as possible, and that dynamic causes them to converge. And so you will find Kresge's and Woolworth's right next door to each other or right across the street from each other. You'll find two gasoline stations next door to each other or at the same corner, that sort of thing. So there were models of geographic competition along a main street. Mm-hmm. And these models have been imported into politics because a number of people said, Kresge's and Woolworth's sounds like Democrats and Republicans. Where will they locate if they want to minimize their ideological distance from as many voters as possible? This will cause the tendency to converge toward each other. And this was an interesting argument, explaining why many, many visitors to America over a century or more had described the American political parties as Tweedledum and Tweedledee. So it was arguments like those that were imported from economics, or I should say exported by economists into political science. So the classics of the late 50s and early 60s involved included Downs, a man named Mansur Olson, James Buchanan, and Gordon Tullock. And Riker was kind of a buddy of these guys. The regularity that Riker was puzzled by was that coalitions of winners tended to become as small as possible while still staying winning, what he called minimum winning coalitions. And even when, for some reason, the opposition collapsed entirely and you had a coalition of the whole winning, the era of good feeling in the United States in 1820, the Federalists had disappeared, it was just the Jeffersonians. Well, by 1824, they were squabbling among each other, and factions were developing, and they were splitting off and paring down the size of their winning coalition. And the logic is pretty simple. If you think of a bunch of pigs at a trough, you know, for a fixed trough, the fewer pigs there are, the more there is to go around. You don't want to have too few pigs, because then they can't defend the trough. But as long as they can defend the trough, you don't want any more than you need to maximize the per capita share that individuals would get. So that was kind of the logic behind minimum winning coalitions. And so Riker got very interested in that. And the new tool, the new kid on the block, was game theory. And he had somewhat accidentally run across a copy of von Neumann and Morgenstern's classic. And he just said, this is political science. And,
how long after the von Neumann work was this?
The story Riker told me was he was teaching at Lawrence College in Appleton, Wisconsin, in the mid-50s, and it's a small college where there aren't very many political scientists, and you talk to a lot of other academic colleagues, and a biologist friend of his had come across the book and passed it on to him, saying, this is a great book. And So it was probably 55, you know, within a decade of the publication of that. And so a game theory was an important part of the curriculum at Rochester. We all learned game theory along with our econometrics and decision theory and things like that.
Was that exciting for you when you first read it?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. It was really quite a remarkable book. I guess at that time, very young scholars, Luce and Rafa became something of a Bible of game theory. It was two social scientists who brought it to life, maintaining much but not all of the mathematical rigor, but allowing it to flourish conceptually, I think. I think it popularized game theory among a broad swath of the young students that are coming to the subject. It certainly became the kind of the text of choice. I don't know that many people read von Neumann and Morgenstern. Many more cited than have read it, I'm sure.
So where were you at this point while these texts?
Well, this was all, there was this nascent interest in mathematical models. There was this philosophy of explaining regularities against the backdrop of a fairly traditional discipline on the one hand, and a scientific impulse that was mainly empirical on the other. And I don't know, as a student, I just sort of took it all in. I think there might have among students been, I will plead guilty to thinking about good guys and bad guys as you try to craft your own identity. And I think there was a real sense of the Rochester students being a mutant band that needed to look out for one another. And there was a tremendous implicit networking that was done. By the late 60s, early 70s, a number of departments around the country said, we want one of you, but probably not more than one of you. And so we were being hired at mostly minor institutions, and we had very few colleagues to interact with at our own institutions from our tribe. And so we maintained contacts among each other, and there was an awful lot of that was very, very supportive, I think, and really was important to the development.
But you didn't feel isolated?
A little bit. I remember feeling doubly isolated. I was in St. Louis, which had a fantastic, wonderful university. I mean, it was just a tremendous place to be. But it was in the middle of the country. Not many people passed through St. Louis on the way to somewhere else. It wasn't Cambridge or the Bay Area. And so you had to make an effort. I traveled a lot. I went to lots of meetings because otherwise I would have probably felt more isolated.
That probably helped you traveling a lot. You were meeting all the other
people.
Oh yeah, that did help.
I don't know that I thought strategically about my career at that point. It was just kind of necessary to get on with life. And the more mathematical scientific types in political science are also more naturally collaborative. And so collaborations developed sometimes at long distance, and so travel was necessary. We didn't have email.
Right, I was going to say, now it's different.
Now it's a lot different, right.
Collaborate with people you've never met, I guess.
That's true. But in those days, you kind of used the schedule of regular meetings that you knew you would be jointly attending and filled in with extra travel to get together three or four times a year, maybe, to maintain the collaboration.
What sorts of research subjects did you take on, or how did you choose them?
Well, I would say there were two major research subjects that I first focused on. One was in my dissertation, and I got interested in the idea I just mentioned a moment ago about candidates converging toward each other. The way to think about candidates at that point were that there were points on a line, and voters were also points on the line. And voters looked at the two objects on offer and said, which one is closer to my point, to my ideal point, and voted for that one. And I was in Rochester in the late 1960s, and the governor of New York was a man named Nelson Rockefeller, who was always running for the Republican nomination. And I had noticed something very odd, that here I read the New York Times every day, and this is 1968, 1969, he had said nothing about the Vietnam War. Now, this was the major issue of the time, and he said nothing. And I said, wait a minute, these models that have candidates as well-defined points on the line, but they're not. I mean, basically voting for Rockefeller was like buying a lottery ticket. In fact, that's what I decided, that actually the generalization of a point on a line is a probability distribution over points on the line. So I wrote a dissertation called The Strategy of Ambiguity, in which I represented politicians as probability distributions. So instead of selecting a point on a line, they're selecting a function over points on the line.
Because they never play their hands fully to the public.
Ex post, you find out what they stand for because they start implementing policies. Ex ante, they're making promises, and they may say one thing to one audience and something else to another audience, or they may use vague language, or they may say nothing at all. Richard Nixon in 1968 said, "I have a plan." And when asked to fill in the details, he would always say, "I don't want to undercut President Johnson's efforts to bring peace in Vietnam. So if elected, I have a plan for peace in Vietnam." That was his way of being ambiguous. And so that was one set of things that I was curious about, and so I wrote down models of sort of strategic competition in which the choices weren't mere points on lines, but probability distributions over points. And I published 3 or 4 papers out of my dissertation on that.
Is ambiguity more advantageous then, I would assume, for a politician to be more?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. The first major paper I published was in 1972, and 30-some years later, I still see it cited, so I'm not sure the issue has ever been settled yet. I don't think that my particular approach was necessarily the best one. It did seem so at the time, and there's been progress, I'm happy to say. So there are different circumstances in which ambiguity would be advantage. And so one of the interesting things I uncovered was an explanation why sometimes politics makes strange bedfellows, that you might imagine extremists would prefer a 50-50 chance of their position prevailing by picking a very ambiguous candidate to the compromise candidate. Extremists feel so intensely about their position that a compromise looks almost as bad as the other guy winning altogether. So I would associate ambiguity as the kind of strategy that would be appealing in a world in which people had intense preferences. So that's one kind of implication of the argument. The second major project I got interested in was about Congress. And one of the most important features of the Congress is its committee system. And one of the most important things new members need to attend to right after the election is getting onto committees that will help them in their careers. And I found this to be a very mathematical kind of thing. You have a set of vacancies across a bunch of committees, and you have a bunch of guys, and it's a bit like putting balls into urns.
How do they organize?
There are various ways to sort all the balls available into all the urns that are available. How does the Committee on Committees do it? And again, there are lots of mathematical models of balls and urns, and so it did reflect my kind of natural inclination about ways to think about problems. Is on the one hand, I devour the Washington Post and I read about Congress and spend a lot of time on Capitol Hill interviewing congressmen. It's very much the way a more conventional political scientist would go about his or her business. But on the other hand, I'm kind of thinking balls and urns and thinking, what off-the-shelf model is there that I can steal? I always tell my students that creativity is stealing some other guy's idea and using it in ways that he or she had no intention. And so I did think a lot about what turned out there was a large literature called optimal assignment problems. And it's the same assigning legislators to committees is the same as assigning undergraduates to dorms. In traditional societies, assigning women to men in a marriage market, assigning interns to hospitals. I mean, it's a generic problem. And those are the kinds of problems that I really love to discover. It's a problem that may manifest itself in a particular way in a political setting, but it's really a generic problem.
You said you found optimal assignment problem. Were you aware of it before you?
No.
So this just fit neatly in with...
Oh yeah, I was sort of interested in committees and committee assignments and Congress, and began to think about matching what I was seeing to, you know, just reading things. And it turned out it's a fairly specific subset of what are called programming models. linear and dynamic programming models. So I've always sort of felt slightly schizophrenic in terms of focusing on two different kinds of things. But a lot of the Rochester people, I think the success of mathematical approaches in political science came not only from a group that only did the mathematics, but these people were sort of passionate about studying politics. And they had, you know, interests in theories of war or theories of electoral competition or theories of legislative organization or Supreme Court decisions. And part of the initial approach is, are there garden variety models out there that seem to match up with the phenomena in question? And that begins a creative period of tweaking those models to make them fit the particulars of the situation.
When you find a model like that that works, do you have the temptation to start looking elsewhere to apply it?
I think you do. I'm in a bit of a phase like that at the moment. I'm interested in intertemporal phenomena. And there is a class of games called repeat play games, in which you take some one-shot game and repeat it over time. And there's been a lot of work in game theory on repeat play. And repeat play is thought of as one of the potential solutions to problems that have been uncovered, like the prisoner's dilemma you may have heard of. The prisoner's dilemma is a problem when it's a one-shot game. But if you take the prisoner's dilemma and the two players, the row player and the column player, and you have them not only play it once, but play it repeatedly, they can evolve various strategies of cooperation that would never emerge if the game were only played once. And so repeat play had become very au courant. And
so it gives it sort of a statistical bent almost? Or?
Well, it gives it a dynamic flavor. Many of the models of repeat play made demographically implausible assumptions, such as infinitely live players who play this game forever. There had been developments in which people asked, what if we thought of finite lived players, but that the game was infinitely repeated, but every so often a player died and was replaced by somebody else, but the game kept going on. That is there a logic to ongoing organizations, so to speak, even though the compositions of those organizations may be changing over time? And this is called overlapping generations game theory. And this just caught my fancy. I don't know why, but I just thought this was really interesting because a lot of the repeat play models had these empirically implausible requirements. And I said, aha, this is a tweak on repeat play that uses empirically more plausible ones. Finitely lived agents, constantly shifting compositions of groups, the group goes on. And I got very interested in it and then began to see instances of it everywhere. For one thing, I thought in a world like that, if you thought of a legislature as comprised of generations, if you take any cross-section of a legislature, you'll see different generations, the senior old guys, the veterans, and the young rookies. And people move through the hierarchy as they age in the organization. And I thought, well, what if one did have a game among people of different generations, with the seniors having a shorter time horizon, the juniors having a longer time horizon, and I devised models in which seniority pops out, worlds in which young people bear costs up front in the anticipation that when they're old, they can live off the fat of the land, and the next generation of young people will be bearing those costs. And that looked like a seniority system in a legislature in which the time in the queue determined the benefits that you got relative to the cost you bear. And I thought, but okay, that sounds like tenure systems in universities. And that sounds like age grading in primitive societies in which youngsters are males, are their private property of their families when they're very young. And, you know, they mind animals. And then there's a rite of passage. And they become the public property of the tribe, and they provide public goods, like defense. And then there's another rite of passage, and they become elders, and they're given land and cattle and women, and they live off the public goods that are being provided by the younger generations. So that looked like a seniority system to me. Pension schemes, if you think of the players as generations, The young generations pay into a pay-as-you-go system. The old generation draws out. So
Social Security.
Social Security. Most pension systems work this way, in which you have these overlapping generations at any one time. Your society is composed of older, middle-aged, and young. And the seniority system that seems to be in equilibrium is the young and the middle-aged pay in, the old get to draw out. That's the way the pension system works. And I became interested in characterizing these systems on the one hand, and also trying to understand what sustained them and what disrupted them. And indeed, one thing that disrupts them are baby booms, population instability. So in the pension scheme, we know from reading the newspapers every day that this big generation, the pig and the python, the baby boomers, has caused great stress on the system. And indeed, it's more important, not only was there a baby boom, but there was a baby dearth after that. So it was a big generation followed by a small generation.
Nobody paying in after.
So fewer paying in, more drawing out, put stress on the system. The same thing happened in the 1974 congressional election, the Watergate election. That was a baby boom. There were 90 freshman congressmen elected in that legislature. That's, you know, you think of any company that in which turnover of its management is 20-30%, that's big. So, and indeed the seniority system in Congress fell just after that. It was baby boomers looking around, baby boomers, 74 freshmen, looking around saying there are too many of us, our chances of surviving is too high, we now know how to win re-election as incumbents, and there are too few prizes. So the first thing that happened is that the Democrats voted to disband the seniority system and instituted the popular election of chairs of committees. And secondly, they created more prizes, subcommittees. There was this flourishing of subcommittees. So the idea was you provide a lot of intermediate prizes along the way. It's like sort of giving 40-year-old sabbatical leaves or something. Not quite retirement, but you get a year off. So there was this family of models, as I say, that derived from these overlapping generation game theory, repeat play games. But there's a bunch of different phenomena that seem to be different manifestations of it. And so that's kind of the way I think about problems is, I want to explain something like seniority in legislatures, but then I want to see whether or not if this isn't an instance of something more generic and try to find different settings in which it might arise.
And see if there's already a mathematical model of sorts.
And also to put, yeah, to, I don't want to have to invent the mathematics. I can't do that very well. I mean, there are other people, I do believe in the division of labor, and there are other people who do that. But I would take a model and tweak it in various ways to bring it into line with the phenomena I'm interested in.
And they work pretty well predictively? I mean, you can
I don't think we want to go there. it's not unique to my work, but there is still a disconnect between those that do modeling and those that test it and use it as a predictive tool. Mm-hmm. Statistical models have lent themselves to testing and prediction to a much greater extent than mathematical models. That is, mathematical models have to go through this next stage of development in which they're operationalized and appropriate data brought to bear and so on. And there is a division of labor. And so an awful lot of people who do the mathematical modeling did not nearly do as much of the operationalization and testing. And so in a way, that element of the scientific process was truncated. Now, what has developed, I think, in recent years has been this blossoming of experimental methods. And a number of people who do modeling also do experiments. Experiments is perhaps a slightly more accessible way to test out ideas. They don't require you to get up and running a great big sample survey or something much more expensive. And so I think many modelers have now turned to experiments, and experimental laboratories now are the hot new piece of infrastructure that people seek out.
Is there any aspect of evolution to these, though, that might part of the reason you don't want to be predictive with them, that you don't have the new data coming in that might alter slightly or tweak the theory?
Well, I think in the first instance, it's simply a matter of actually testing, and testing entails fairly large fixed costs. Once you get things up and running, whether it's an experimental laboratory or a reliable large N sample survey, then you can begin to use those data to test a lot of different things. So it's overcoming the fixed costs of doing it for the first time. That is the challenge. And so, as I say, a lot of people just spent time creating these models, these analytical approaches, and the first bit of testing they would do would not be systematic, but rather anecdotal. There's the old line that the plural of anecdote is data. And so, especially those of us that studied Congress, legislatures, we would have an argument about the committee system or about amendment processes or about conference committees and bicameralism. And then we would go to Capitol Hill and just talk to people. And essentially it was, are we in the right ballpark here? This is not rocket science. This is not subtle testing of details of a model. This is, are we in the right ballpark? And I mean, is this a reasonable way to think about what you guys are doing? And so there actually was quite a strong bond that developed between people who did models and people who hung out on Capitol Hill. And so the scholars, the legislative scholars and the modelers actually began to resonate to one another's work. The legislative scholars appreciated that the modelers actually paid attention to their work. And the modelers actually appreciated that the legislative scholars were one community in conventional political science that wasn't put off entirely by models. And so there was a real collaboration that took place over a long period of time between communities that I think made both communities better at what they were doing. And it became something of an exemplar for how modeling and observational social science can work, you know, hand in glove.
Best case scenario.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there were a lot of much worse case scenarios. In many other fields of political science, the more conventional scholars were intimidated, the modelers were more aggressive, we're better than you are, and that was disastrous. And that was not a formula for progress. And so it worked differently in different of the subfields of political science. Certainly in the early days it worked differently. Now I think as more and more generations of graduate students go through graduate training in which they acquire both a substantive interest and these skills, they're doing the arbitrage for us. And so I think nowadays it is pretty standard fare in most of the great research PhD programs for students to get training in game theory, training in statistics, training in experiments, and they'll go off and learn about the politics of Great Britain or American elections or development phenomena or whatever. And it's a common set of tools that are now being brought to bear on these.
When you study the Congress, do you ever go straight to the source, as it were?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and you received well?
Straight to the source mean talking to congressmen and staff people? Oh, yeah. For my very first early project on committee assignments, I came to Capitol Hill and interviewed all the congressmen that served on the committee on committee for the Democrats. And the day I arrived in Washington was the day that Wilbur Mills fell into the tidal basin. You may be too young to even remember. Wilbur Mills was the very powerful chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And he had, through alcoholism or mental illness of some sort, had just had a breakdown. And the Park Police had to pull him out of the tidal basin one night. And his career was finished, but he was one of the great, great members of the House for a long time. But in that book, I spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill talking to congressmen. And just recently, I was on Capitol Hill talking to staff directors, they're called clerks, of the majority-minority clerks of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittees for another project I'm involved in. You talk to them a lot. I don't know, staff often have law degrees or sometimes political science undergraduate degrees, and they kind of say, oh, the professor's coming, you know. But and the congressmen I haven't interviewed congressmen in quite a while. When I did it, it was great fun, mm-hmm. and they seem to enjoy it too. But I don't know how seriously they take us. You kind of have to put on a bit of an act and scuff your feet and say, "Oh shucks, I'm just an academic, and all I know is book learning, and I'm here to hear it from you." And
put on your patch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do these types of characters, like the person you mentioned, the sort of crash and burn types? Is there a model that they fit into? Is that a recurring? I mean, you see this with the Newt Gingrich type of.
I mean, in this case, it was just a random illness, I think.
So you don't see certain people.
I think people reach beyond their grasp, and so they do fall on their face. But it's a pretty structured world on the Hill, I think. And so, I mean, some characters aspire to be transformational, like Gingrich, and he was. But most people are following, it's pretty scripted, I would say. And so watching Majority Leader Frist and Minority Leader Reid interacting, it's a dance that looks familiar. You've seen it before.
Are they conscious of that, do you think? Or
I think so. Uh-huh. I think so. I think there's always uncertainty in the environment, and that's what gives it its novelty, is there are some parameters that you don't know the value of as you're engaging in this. So both Frist and Reid must be very uncertain about, will the Republicans look radical if they go with the nuclear option on the filibuster? Mm-hmm. Will the Democrats look obstructionist if they continue filibustering? How's that going to play with Joe Sixpack? And in particular, the 33 senators up for re-election in 2006 must be saying, we got to figure this out. I mean, we don't know how it's going to play in our constituencies, and that's what we're worried about right now. You know, in the Senate, there's a group of senators that are said to be in cycle. That is, they're the next group up for a re-election. In the House, everyone's up. Everyone's always in cycle. In the Senate, it's a third of the body, and it's like a good hanging. It really does focus the mind. These guys are really focused in the last 2 years on how anything is going to play back home. And they're always concerned about that, obviously, but in the first 4 years, they still always feel they've got time to make up for whatever might happen. But I think the majority-minority leader go do this dance all the time, but there are uncertainties in every such circumstance, and that's what makes them hedge their bets and look for compromise and so on.
And the influence of special interest groups or small but vocal constituencies, has that been pretty consistent?
I think the growth of the Washington community has been something that's a dramatic change from 25 years ago.
Like 50 lobbyists?
Or 50 years ago, I mean, the data that simply look at the number of registered lobbyists would reveal this exponential growth in lobbyists and political law firms. The K Street corridor is bulging with these types. So technologically and organizationally, it is just possible for collections of individuals to overcome their collective action problems and mobilize. And so that is now part of a legislator's environment. His environment or her environment is mediated. His or her relationship to constituencies, the relationships are mediated by organized interests. And I mean, it's neither good nor bad. I'm not making a moral judgment about them. It's just part of the furniture.
But since it's changed over the years, that's been part of the tweaking of the model that's been done?
Yeah, I mean, I think more and more models, some of the early models were models in which legislator constituency relationships were relatively unmediated. Mm-hmm. The legislator was an agent. He had a collection of principals for whom he worked and with whom he was under contract. He wanted to renew that contract every 2 years or every 6 years, and he did a bunch of things in order to do that. I mean, that was kind of the general idea. And now it is the case that in order to renew that contract, you need not only to connect directly with Joe Sixpack, but you need to also accumulate resources to multiply your capacity to make contact. And that's where special interests come in. They provide resources, whether it's their ability to mobilize their voters, their communications institutions, newsletters, etc., websites, and their campaign contributions. So a legislator is sitting there saying, I want to both do things that appeal to the folks back home on the one hand, and do things that appeal to relevant special interests on the other, because they provide resources with which I can appeal to the folks back home.
I wanted to ask you about the peristhetic of big choices. That sort of...
It's funny. It's a paper I did with a graduate student of mine then, and she is now at the University of Michigan, and it was for a conference, and the guys who organized the conference never got their act together, and so it never, you know, there's supposed to be a conference volume, and it never happened, so it's never been published, this paper.
That has something to do with how changes are made or not made.
Yeah, the point of the conference was, these were two guys from Quebec, and the big choices that Quebecers face is devolution, secession, and so on. Israelis have big choices with regard to the peace process. European electorates have big choices about whether to join the EU or not. So these are not the ordinary, everyday kinds of choices. These are big transformational choices. And most of the work on that kind of choice has been slightly psychological. It's how do the organizers, the proponents, frame the choice in a way to extract support, and how do the opponents frame it differently. And Riker, in his last book, it was actually published posthumously, wrote about the campaign to ratify the Constitution as an example of one of these big choices. And the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists framed the debate as they moved around from state legislature to state legislature trying to get this Constitution ratified. And so the debate didn't take place in person. It was, you know, Madison and Jay and Hamilton writing what became the Federalist Papers, but these were newspaper articles, and various others writing newspaper articles, debating back and forth the merits and demerits of the new Constitution, trying to get the New York legislature or the Virginia legislature to ratify it. And the issue was one of how do you frame it. Supporters are looking for hooks. What arguments really seem to work? And they get rid of and stop using arguments that don't seem to work. And so that was the thrust of Riker's last book. Mm-hmm. And my student and I, she is an Israeli, suggested that there is another dimension to framing. It's not only what works psychologically. There are institutional developments. In particular, I can't remember the example that we used. It had to do with Barak, who was the then Prime Minister of Israel, promising, if he signed a peace treaty with Arafat, that he would submit it to popular referendum. He was trying to convey to the electorate that his Labor government would not simply go off and do something without coming back to the people for a final approval. And what we explored in this paper were the different ways in which Barak could sequence things. Small things like, do we pick the day for the referendum as the same day as the Tel Aviv mayoral election, piggybacking on the turnout that's likely to occur for that election. There are lots of institutional moves that proponents could make in this case that had nothing to do with the psychology of it. It was just, as incumbents, we can select many of the terms and conditions under which the choice will be taken. Mm-hmm. And so we explored that.
But your major thrust of your work now is still with the Congress?
It's this overlapping generations, game theory application to these intertemporal phenomena, intertemporal deals of one sort or another. And there are a lot of people now interested in these. I mean, one puzzle, for example, is how do you get people to contribute to some project or objective, like cleaning the environment, which will take seven generations before the benefits arrive. So they won't enjoy the benefits. Their children won't enjoy the benefits. It's their children's children's children. I mean, indeed, strangers.
Yes.
People not much more related to you genetically than your friends or strangers, for that matter. So how do you induce people to engage in that kind of behavior? I mean, that's part of the dilemma of current global warming, greenhouse gases kinds of phenomena, is there are a lot of upfront costs and there aren't very many upfront benefits to contemporaneous generations. So it's how do you structure things to induce this kind of behavior? How do you arrange taxes and subsidies of one sort or another to induce people acting on their own narrow self-interest to do something that will have these beneficial effects decades from now.
But the way you worded it sounds like you're studying it in a way that can be implemented as well as studying systems.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I am interested in when we can be confident that there may be a method of implementation and when we can be confident that the circumstances are simply not ripe. I think that when you have, as I said, these ebbs and flows of population really do disrupt intertemporal deals. The intertemporal deal in the 19th century, in many countries of the developed world for sure, you were having continuously rising populations. Every year you knew the population would grow by a bigger amount than the year before. And so you could put in place these what now seem like Ponzi schemes, because you always knew that the next base was going to be bigger than the base before it. Well, what happens when that's not true? My generation is probably the last generation that benefited by that assumption. And we were the big generation. Yeah, and we may be the last generation whose standard of living was higher than its preceding generation. I'm not sure our kids can count on a standard of living as high as their parents and so on. So
for a variety of reasons, I guess.
For a variety of reasons. And so there are a lot of new rules that have to be invented. You know, the old rules don't work.
Would you take part in advising on that then?
No,
Just do the studies and...
I'm a scholar, I'm a teacher. My objectives in life are to do research and to produce new students. I just have never been involved in the more public side of things.
You just hope that the right people find the research and use it then?
My satisfaction is just in kind of playing with ideas. And I'm not nearly so animated by changing the world. I leave that to others. There are plenty who want to do that.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.